Then. It took B.B. Roth and his children, that's what he called them, only 45 minutes to go over the Buick from stem to stern, the young people dusting and brushing and snapping pictures, B.B. with a clipboard walking around and sometimes pointing wordlessly at something with his ballpoint pen. About 20 minutes into it, Orv Garrett came out with Mr. Dillon. The dog was on his leash, which was a rarity around the barracks. Sandy walked over to them. The dog wasn't howling, had quit trembling, and was sitting with his brush of tail curled neatly over his paws, but his dark brown eyes were fixed on the Buick and never moved. From deep in his chest, almost too low to hear, came a steady growl like the rumble of a powerful motor.
"For Christ's sake, Orvy, take him back inside," Sandy Dearborn said. "Okay, I just thought he might be over it by now."
He paused, then said, "I've heard bloodhounds act that way sometimes when they found a body. I know there's no body, but do you think someone might have died in there?"
"Not that we know of."
Sandy was watching Tony Shandings come out of the barracks side door and amble over to B.B. Roth. Ennis was with him. Kurt Wilcox was out on patrol again, much against his wishes. Sandy doubted that even pretty girls would be able to talk him into giving them warnings instead of tickets that afternoon. Kurt wanted to be at the barracks, watching B.B. and his crew at work, not out on the road. If he couldn't be, lawbreakers in western Pennsylvania would pay. Mr. Dillon opened his mouth and let loose a long, low whine, as if something in him hurt. Sandy supposed something did. Orville took him inside. 5 minutes later, Sandy himself was rolling again, along with Steve Devo, to the scene of a two-car collision out on Highway 6. B.B. Roth made his report to Tony and Ennis as the members of his crew, there were three of them, sat at a picnic table in the shade of Shed B, eating sandwiches and drinking the iced tea Matt Babicki had run out to them.
"I appreciate you taking the time to do this," Tony said.
"Your appreciation is appreciated," B.B. said. "And I hope it ends there. I don't want to submit any paperwork on this one, Tony. No one would ever trust me again."
He looked at his crew and clapped his hands like Miss Francis on Ding Dong School.
"Do we want paperwork on this job, children?"
One of the children who helped that day was appointed Pennsylvania's chief medical examiner in 1993. They looked at him, two young men and a young woman of extraordinary beauty. Their sandwiches were raised, their brows creased. None of them was sure what response was required.
"No, B.B.," he prompted them.
"No, B.B.," they chorused dutifully.
"No what?" B.B. asked.
"No paperwork," said young man number one.
"No file copies," said young man number two.
"No duplicate or triplicate,"
said the young woman of extraordinary beauty.
"Not even any singlicate."
"Good," he said. "And with whom are we going to discuss this, Kinder?"
This time they needed no prompting.
"No one, B.B.,"
"Exactly,"
B.B. agreed. "I'm proud of you."
"Gotta be a joke anyway," said one of the young men. "Someone's tricking on you, Sarge."
"I'm keeping that possibility in mind," Tony said, wondering what any of them would have thought if they had seen Mr. Dillon howling and hunching forward like a crippled thing. Mr. D hadn't been tricking on nobody. The children went back to munching and slurping and talking among themselves. B.B., meanwhile, was looking at Tony and Ennis Rafferty with a slanted little smile.
"They see what they look at with youth's wonderful 20/20 vision and don't see it at the same time," he said. "Young people are such wonderful idiots. What is that thing, Tony? Do you have any idea from witnesses, perhaps?"
"No."
B.B. turned his attention to Ennis, who perhaps thought briefly about telling the man what he knew of the Buick story and then decided not to. B.B. was a good man, but he didn't wear the gray.
"It's not an automobile, that's for sure," B.B. said. "But a joke? No,
I don't think it's that, either.
Is there blood? Tony asked, not knowing if he wanted there to be or not.
Only more microscopic examination of the samples we took can determine that for sure, but I think not.
Certainly no more than trace amounts, if there is.
What did you see?
In a word, nothing.
We took no samples from the tire treads because there's no dirt, or mud, or pebbles, or glass, or grass, or anything else in them.
I would have said that was impossible.
Henry there, he pointed to young man number one, kept trying to wedge a pebble between two of them, and it kept falling out.
Now, what is that?
Why is that?
And could you patent such a thing? If you could, Tony, you could take early retirement.
Tony was rubbing his cheek with the tips of his fingers, the gesture of a perplexed man.
Listen to this, Beebe said.
We're talking floor mats here. Great little dirt catchers, as a rule, every one a geological survey. Usually. Not here, though. A few smudges of dirt, a dandelion stalk. That's all.
He looked at Ennis.
From your partner's shoes, I expect. You say he got behind the wheel?
Yes.
Driver's side footwell. And that's where these few artifacts were found.
Beebe patted his palms together as if to say QED.
Are there prints? Tony asked.
Three sets.
All one comparison prints from your two officers and the pump jockey.
The prints we lifted from the gas hatch will almost certainly belong to the pump jockey.
You agree?
Most likely, Tony said. You'd run the prints on your own time?
Absolutely, my pleasure. The fiber samples as well. Don't annoy me by asking for anything involving the gas chromatograph in Pittsburgh. There's a good fellow. I will pursue this as far as the equipment in my basement permits.
That will be quite far.
You're a good guy, Beebe.
Yes, and even the best guy will take a free dinner from time to time if a friend offers.
He'll offer. Meantime, is there anything else?
The glass is glass. The wood is wood. But a wooden dashboard in a car of this vintage, this purported vintage, is completely wrong. My older brother had a Buick from the late 50s, a Limited. I learned to drive on it, and I remember it well, with fear and affection. The dashboard was padded vinyl. I would say the seat covers in this one are vinyl, which would be right for this make and model. I will be checking with General Motors to make sure.
The odometer? Very amusing. Did you notice the odometer?
Ennis shook his head. He looked hypnotized.
All zeros. Which is fitting, I suppose. That car, that purported car, would never drive.
His eyes moved from Ennis to Tony and then back to Ennis again.
Tell me you haven't seen it drive. That you haven't seen it move a single inch under its own power.
Actually, I haven't, Ennis said.
Which was true.
There was no need to add that Bradley Roach claimed to have seen it moving under its own power, and that Ennis, a veteran of many interrogations, believed him.
Good.
Beebe looked relieved. He clapped his hands, once more being Miss Francis.
Time to go, children. Voice your thanks.
Thanks, Sergeant, they chorused. The young woman of extraordinary beauty finished her iced tea, belched, and followed her white-coated colleagues back to the car in which they had come. Tony was fascinated to note that not one of the three gave the Buick a look. To them, it was now a closed case, and new cases lay ahead. To them, the Buick was just an old car, getting older by the minute in the summer sun. So what if pebbles fell out when placed between the knuckles of the tread, even when placed so far up along the curve of the tire that gravity should have held them in? So what if there were three portholes on one side instead of four?
They see it and don't see it at the same time, Beebe had said. Young people are such wonderful idiots. Beebe followed his wonderful idiots toward his own car. Beebe liked to ride to crime scenes in solitary splendor whenever possible, then stopped.
I said the wood is wood, the vinyl is vinyl, and the glass is glass. You heard me say that?
Tony and Ennis nodded.
It appears to me that this purported car's exhaust system is also made of glass. Now, of course, I was only peering under from one side, but I had a flashlight, quite a powerful one.
For a few moments, he just stood there, staring at the Buick parked in front of Shed B, hands in his pockets, rocking back and forth on the balls of his feet.
I have never heard of a car with a glass exhaust system, he said finally, and then walked toward his car.
A moment later, he and his children were gone. Tony was uncomfortable with the car out where it was, not just because of possible storms, but because anyone who happened to walk out back could see it. Visitors were what he was thinking of, Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Public. The state police served John Q. and his family as well as they could, in some cases at the cost of their lives. They did not, however, completely trust them. John Q.'s family was not Troop D.'s family. The prospect of word getting around, worse, of rumor getting around, made Sergeant Chaindinks squirm. He strolled to Johnny Parker's little office. The county motor pool was still next door in those days, around 2:45, and sweet-talked Johnny into moving one of the plows out of Shed B and putting the Buick inside. A pint of whiskey sealed the deal, and the Buick was towed into the oil-smelling darkness that became its home. Shed B had garage doors at either end, and Johnny brought the Buick in through the back one. As a result, it faced the Troop D barracks from out there for all the years of its stay. It was something most of the troopers became aware of as time passed. Not a forebrained thing, not like an organized thought, but something that floated at the back of the mind, never quite formed and never quite gone. The pressure of its chrome grin.
There were 18 troopers assigned to Troop D in 1979, rotating through the usual shifts, 7-3, 3-11, and the graveyard shift, when they rode 2 to a cruiser. On Fridays and Saturdays, the 11-7 shift was commonly called Puke Patrol. By 4 o'clock on the afternoon the Buick arrived, most of the off-duty troopers had heard about it and dropped by for a look. Sandy Dearborn, back from the accident on Highway 6 and typing up the paperwork, saw them going out there in murmuring threes and fours, almost like tour groups. Kurt Wilcox was off-duty by then, and he conducted a good many of the tours himself, pointing out the mismatched portholes and big steering wheel, lifting the hood so they could marvel over the whacked-out mill with Buick 8 printed on both sides of the engine block. Orv Garrett conducted other tours, telling the story of Mr. D's reaction over and over again. Sergeant Chaindinks, already fascinated by the thing, a fascination that would never completely leave him until Alzheimer's erased his mind, came out as often as he could. Sandy remembered him standing just outside the open Shed B door at one point, foot up on the boards behind him, arms crossed. Ennis was beside him, smoking one of those little tipperillos he liked and talking while Tony nodded. It was after 3, and Ennis had changed into jeans and a plain white shirt. After 3, and that was the best Sandy could say later on, he wished he could do better. But he couldn't. The cops came. They looked at the engine, the hood permanently up by that point, gaping like a mouth. They squatted down to look at the exotic glass exhaust system. They looked at everything. They touched nothing. John Q. and his family wouldn't have known to keep their mitts off. But these were cops. They understood that while the Buick might not be an evidential res as of right then, later on that might change. Especially if the man who had left it at the Jenny station should happen to turn up dead.
Unless that happens or something else pops, I intend to keep the car here, Tony told Matt Babicki and Phil Candleton at one point. It was 5 o'clock or so by then. All three of them had been officially off duty for a couple of hours, and Tony was finally thinking about going home. Sandy himself had left around 4, wanting to mow the grass before sitting down to dinner.
"Well, why here?" Matt asked. "What's the big deal, Sarge?"
Tony asked Matt and Phil if they knew about the Card of Giant. They said they didn't, and so Tony told them the story. The Giant had been discovered in upstate New York's Onondaga Valley. It was supposed to be the fossilized corpse of a gigantic humanoid, maybe something from another world, or the missing link between men and apes. It turned out to be nothing but a hoax perpetrated by a Binghamton cigar maker named George Hull. "But before Hull fessed up," Tony said, "just about everyone in the whole round world, including P.T. Barnum, dropped by for a look. The crops on the surrounding farms were trampled to mush. Houses were broken into. There was a forest fire started by asshole John Q's camping in the woods, even after Hull confessed to having the petrified man carved in Chicago and shipped Railway Express to upstate New York. People kept coming. They refused to believe the thing wasn't real. You've heard the saying, 'There's a sucker born every minute'? That was coined in 1869 in reference to the Card of Giant."
"Well, what's your point?" Phil asked.
Tony gave him an impatient look.
"The point?
The point is that I'm not having any Cardiff fucking Giant on my watch, not if I can help it, or the goddamn Buick of Turin, for that matter." As they moved back toward the barracks, Huddy Royer joined them, with Mr. Dillon at his side, now healing as neatly as a pooch in a dog show. Huddy caught the Buick of Turin line and snickered. Tony gave him a doer look. "No Cardiff Giant in Western PA. You boys mark what I say and pass the word, because word of mouth's how it's going to be done. I'm not tacking any memo up on the bulletin board. I know there'll be some gossip, but it'll die down. I will not have a dozen Amish farms overrun by looky-loos in the middle of the growing season. Is that understood?" It was understood. By 7 o'clock that evening, things had returned to something like normal. Sandy Dearborn knew that for himself, because he'd come back after dinner for his own encore look at the car. He found only 3 troopers, 2 off-duty and 1 in uniform, strolling around the Buick. Buck Flanders, one of the off-duties, was snapping pictures with his Kodak. That made Sandy a bit uneasy, but what would they show? A Buick, that was all. One not yet old enough to be an official antique. Sandy got down on his hands and knees and peered under the car, using a flashlight that had been left nearby, and probably for just that purpose. He took a good gander at the exhaust system. To him, it looked like Pyrex glass. He leaned in the driver's window for a while. No hum, no chill. Then went back to the barracks to shoot the shit with Brian Cole, who was in the SC chair that shift. The two of them started on the Buick, moved on to their families, and had just gotten to baseball when Orville Garrett stuck his head in the door. "Either of you guys seen Ennis? The dragon's on the phone, and she's not a happy lady." The dragon was Edith Hyams, Ennis's sister. She was 8 or 9 years older than Ennis, a long-time widow lady. There were those in Troop D who opined that she had murdered her husband, simply nagged him into his grave. "That's not a tongue in her mouth, that's a Ginzu knife," Dickie Duck Elliott observed once. Kurt, who saw the lady more than the rest of the troop, and as was usually his partner, they got on well despite the difference in their ages, was of the opinion that Edith was the reason Trooper Rafferty had never married. "I think that deep down he's afraid they're all like her," he once told Sandy. Coming back to work after your shift is through is never a good idea, Sandy thought, after spending a long 10 minutes on the phone with the dragon.
"Where is he? He promised he'd be home by 6:30 at the latest. I got the roasty one at down at Pepper's, 89 cents a pound. Now it's cooked like an old boot, gray as wash water." Only, of course, what the lady said was wash water. "If he's down at the Country Way or the Tap, you tell me right now, Sandy, so I can call and tell him what's what."
She also informed Sandy that she was out of her water pills, and Ennis was supposed to have brought her a fresh batch. So where the hell was he? Pulling overtime? That would be all right, she reckoned. God knew they could use the money. Only he should have called. Or was he drinking? Although she never came right out and said so, Sandy could tell that the dragon voted for drinking. Sandy was sitting at the dispatch desk, one hand cupped over his eyes, trying to get a word in edgeways, when Curtis Wilcox bopped in, dressed in his civvies and looking every inch the sport. Like Sandy, he'd come back for another peek at the roadmaster.
Hold on, Edith, hold on a second, Sandy said, and put the telephone against his chest. Help me out here, rookie. Do you know where Ennis went after he left?
He left?
Yeah, but he apparently didn't go home. Sandy pointed to the phone, which was still held against his chest. His sister's on the line.
Well, if he left, how come his car is still here? Kurt asked.
Sandy looked at him. Curtis looked back.
And then, without a word spoken, the two of them jumped like Jack and Jill to the same conclusion. Sandy got rid of Edith, told her he'd call her back or have Ennis call her if he was around. That taken care of, Sandy went out back with Kurt. There was no mistaking Ennis's car, the American Motors Gremlin they all made fun of. It stood not far from the plow Johnny Parker had moved out of Shed B to make room for the Buick. The shadows of both the car and the plow straggled long in the declining sun of a summer evening, printed on the earth like tattoos. Sandy and Kurt looked inside the Gremlin and saw nothing but the usual road litter. Hamburger wrappers, soda cans, Tipperillo boxes, couple of maps, an extra uniform shirt hung from the hook in back, an extra citation book on the dusty dashboard, some bits of fishing gear. All that rickrack looked sort of comforting to them after the sterile emptiness of the Buick. The sight of Ennis sitting behind the wheel and snoozing with his old pirate's cap tilted over his eyes would have been even more comforting, but there was no sign of him. Kurt turned and started back toward the barracks. Sandy had to break into a trot in order to catch up and grab his arm.
"Where do you think you're going?" he asked.
"To call Tony."
"Not yet," Sandy said. "Let him have his dinner. We'll call him later if we have to."
"I hope to God we don't." Before checking anything else, even the upstairs common room, Kurt and Sandy checked Shed B. They walked all around the car, looked inside the car, looked under the car. There was no sign of Ennis Rafferty in any of those places, at least not that they could see. Of course, looking for signs in and around the Buick that evening was like looking for the track of one particular horse after a stampede has gone by. There was no sign of Ennis specifically, but
is it cold in here or is it just me? Kurt asked.
They were about ready to return to the barracks. Kurt had been down on his knees with his head cocked, taking a final look underneath the car. Now he stood up, brushing his knees.
"I mean, I know it's not freezing or anything, but it's colder than it should be, wouldn't you say?"
Sandy actually felt too hot. Sweat was running down his face, but that might have been nerves rather than room temperature. He thought Kurt's sense of cold was likely just a holdover from what he'd felt or thought he felt out at the Jenny station. Kurt read that on his face easily enough.
"Maybe it is. Maybe it is just me. Fuck, I don't know. Let's check the barracks. Maybe he's downstairs in supply, cooping. Wouldn't be the first time."
The two men hadn't entered Shed B by either of the big roll-up doors, but rather through the doorknob-operated, people-sized door that was set into the right side. Kurt paused in it instead of going out, looking back over his shoulder at the Buick. His gaze, as he stood beside the wall of pegged hammers, clippers, rakes, shovels, and one pulse-hole digger, the red AA on the handle stood not for Alcoholics Anonymous but Archy Arcanian, was angry. Almost baleful. "It wasn't in my mind," he said, more to himself than to Sandy. "It was cold. It's not now, but it was." Sandy said nothing.
"Tell you one thing," Kurt said. "If that goddamn car is going to be around long, I'm getting a thermometer for this place. I'll pay for it out of my own pocket if I have to. And say, someone left the damn trunk unlocked. I wonder who."
He stopped. Their eyes met, and a single thought flashed between them.
Fine pair of cops we are. They had looked inside the Buick's cabin and underneath, but had ignored the place that was, according to the movies at least, the temporary body disposal site of choice for murderers, both amateur and professional. The two of them walked over to the Buick and stood by the back deck, peering at the line of darkness where the trunk was unlatched. "You do it, Sandy," Kurt said. His voice was low, barely above a whisper. Sandy didn't want to, but decided he had to. Kurt was, after all, still a rookie. He took a deep breath and raised the trunk's lid. It went up much faster than he had expected. There was a clunk when it reached the top of its arc, loud enough to make both men jump. Kurt grabbed Sandy with one hand, his fingers so cold that Sandy almost cried out. The mind is a powerful and often unreliable machine. Sandy was so sure they were going to find Ennis Rafferty in the trunk of the Buick that for a moment he saw the body, a curled, fetal shape in jeans and a white shirt, looking like something a mafia hitman might leave in the trunk of a stolen Lincoln. But it was only overlapped shadows that the two troopers saw. The Buick's trunk was empty. There was nothing there but plain brown carpeting, without a single tool or grease stain on it. They stood in silence for a moment or two, and then Kurt made a sound under his breath, either a snicker or an exasperated snort. "Come on," he said. "Let's get out of here. And shut the damn trunk tight this time, about scare the life out of me." "Me too," Sandy said, and gave the trunk a good hard slam. He followed Kurt to the door beside the wall with the pegged tools on it. Curtis was looking back again. "Isn't that one hell of a thing?" he said softly. "Yes," Sandy agreed. "It's fucked up, wouldn't you say?" "I would, Rook, I would indeed. But your partner isn't in it, or anywhere in here. That much is for sure." Kurt didn't bridle at the word Rook. Those days were almost over for him, and they both knew it. He was still looking at the car, so smooth and cool and there. His eyes were narrow, showing just two thin lines of blue. "It's almost like it's talking. I mean, I'm sure that's just my imagination. Damn tooting it is. But I can almost hear it. Mutter, mutter, mutter." "Quit it before you give me the willies." "You mean you don't already have them?" Sandy chose not to reply to that. "Come on, all right?" They went out, Kurt taking one last look before closing the door. The two of them checked upstairs in the barracks, where there was a living room and, behind a plain blue curtain, a dorm-style bedroom that contained four cots. Andy Colucci was watching a sitcom on television, and a couple of troopers who had the graveyard shift were snoozing. Sandy could hear the snores. He pulled back the curtain to check. Two guys, all right. One of them going, "Wake, wake," through his nose, polite. The other going, "Ronk, ronk, ronk," through his open mouth, big and rude. Neither of them was Ennis. Sandy hadn't really expected to find him there. When Ennis cooped, he most commonly did it in the basement supply room, rocked back in the old swivel chair that went perfectly with the World War II-era metal desk down there, the old cracked radio on the shelf, playing dance band music, soft. He wasn't in the supply room that night, though. The radio was off, and the swivel chair with the pillow on the seat was unoccupied. Nor was he in either of the storage cubicles, which were poorly lit and almost as spooky as cells in a dungeon. There was a total of four toilets in the building, if you included the stainless steel lidless model in the bad boy corner. Ennis wasn't hiding out in any of the three with doors. Not in the kitchenette, not in dispatch, not in the SC's office, which stood temporarily empty with the doors open and the lights off. By then, Huddy Royer had joined Sandy and Kurt. Orville Garrett had gone home for the day, probably afraid that Ennis's sister would turn up in person, and had left Mr. Dillon in Huddy's care, so the dog was there, too. Kurt explained what they were doing and why.
Huddy grasped the implications at once. He had a big, open Farmer John face, but Huddy was a long way from stupid. He led Mr. D to Ennis's locker and let him smell inside, which the dog did with great interest. Andy Colucci joined them at this point, and a couple of other off-duty guys who had dropped by to sneak a peek at the Buick also joined the party. They went outside, split up into two groups, and walked around the building in opposing circles, calling Ennis's name. There was still plenty of good light, but the day had begun to redden. Kurt, Huddy, Mr. D, and Sandy were in one group. Mr. Dillon walked slowly, smelling at everything. But the only time he really perked and turned, the scent he'd caught took him on a beeline to Ennis's gremlin. No help there. At first, yelling Ennis's name felt foolish. But by the time they gave up and went back inside the barracks, it no longer felt that way at all. That was the scary part. How fast yelling for him stopped feeling silly and started feeling serious.
"Let's take Mr. D into the shed and see what he smells there," Kurt proposed.
"No way," Huddy said. "He doesn't like the car."
"Come on, man. Ennie's my partner. Besides, maybe old D will feel different about that car now."
But old D felt just the same. He was okay outside the shed, in fact started to pull on his leash as the troopers approached the side door. His head was down, his nose all but scraping the macadam. He was even more interested when they got to the door itself. The men had no doubt at all that he had caught Ennis's scent, good and strong. Then Curtis opened the door, and Mr. Dillon forgot all about whatever he had been smelling. He started to howl at once, and again hunched over as if struck by bad cramps. His fur bushed out like a peacock's finery, and he squirted urine over the doorstep and onto the shed's concrete floor. A moment later, he was yanking at the leash Huddy was holding, still howling, still trying in a crazy, reluctant way to get inside. He hated it and feared it. That was in every line of his body and in his wild eyes, but he was trying to get at it just the same.
"Oh, never mind. Just get him out," Kurt shouted.
Until then, he had kept hold of himself very well. But it had been a long and stressful day for him, and he was finally nearing the breaking point.
"It's not his fault," Huddy said.
And before he could say more, Mr. Dillon raised his snout and howled again. Only to Sandy, it sounded more like a scream than a howl. The dog took another crippled lurch forward, pulling Huddy's arm out straight like a flag in a high wind. He was inside now, howling and whining, lurching to get forward and pissing everywhere like a pup, pissing in terror.
"I know it's not," Kurt said. "You were right to begin with, and I'll give you a written apology if you want. Just get him the fuck out."
Huddy tried to reel Mr. D back in, but he was a big dog, about 90 pounds, and he didn't want to come. Kurt had to lay on with him in order to get D going in the right direction. In the end, they dragged him out on his side, D fighting and howling and gnashing the air with his teeth the whole way. It was like pulling a sack of polecats, Sandy would say later. When the dog was at last clear of the door, Curtis slammed it shut. The second he did, Mr. Dillon relaxed and stopped fighting. It was as if a switch in his head had been flipped. He continued to lie on his side for a minute or two, getting his breath, then popped to his feet. He gave the troopers a bewildered look that seemed to say, "What happened, boys? I was going along good, and then I kind of blanked out."
"Holy fucking shit," Huddy said in a low voice.
"Take him back to the barracks," Kurt said. "I was wrong to ask you to let him inside there, but I'm awful worried about Ennis."
Huddy took the dog back to the barracks, Mr. D once again as cool as a strawberry milkshake, just pausing to sniff at the shoes of the troopers who had helped search the perimeter. These had been joined by others who had heard Mr. D freaking out and had come to see what all the fuss was.
"Go on in, guys," Sandy said, then added what they always said to the looky-loos who gathered at accident sites. "Show's over."
They went in. Kurt and Sandy watched them standing there by the closed shed door. After a while, Huddy came back without Mr. D.
Sandy watched Kurt reach for the doorknob of the shed door and felt a sense of dread and tension rise in his head like a wave. It was the first time he felt that way about Shed B, but not the last. In the 20-odd years that followed that day, he would go inside Shed B dozens of times, but never without the rise of that dark mental wave, never without the intuition of almost glimpsed horrors, of abominations in the corner of the eye. Not that all of the horrors went unglimpsed. In the end, they glimpsed plenty. The three of them walked in, their shoes gritting on the dirty cement. Sandy flipped on the light switches by the door, and in the glare of the naked bulbs, the Buick stood like one prop left on a bare stage, or the single piece of art in a gallery that had been dressed like a garage for the showing. What would you call such a thing? Sandy wondered. From a Buick 8, was what occurred to him. Probably because there was a Bob Dylan song with a similar title. The chorus was in his head as they stood there, seeming to illuminate that feeling of dread. Well, if I go down dying, you know she bound to put a blanket on my bed. It sat there with its Buick headlights staring and its Buick grill sneering. It sat there on its fat and luxy white walls, and inside was a dashboard full of frozen fake controls and a wheel almost big enough to steer a privateer. Inside was something that made the barracks dog simultaneously howl in terror and yank forward, as if in the grip of some ecstatic magnetism. If it had been cold in there before, it no longer was. Sandy could see sweat shining on the faces of the other two men and feel it on his own. It was Huddy who finally said it out loud, and Sandy was glad. He felt it, but never could have put that feeling into words. It was too outrageous. "Fucking thing ate him," Huddy said with flat certainty. "I don't know how that could be, but I think he came in here by himself to take another look, and it just somehow ate him." Kurt said, "It's watching us. Do you feel it?" Sandy looked at the glassy headlight eyes, at the downturned, sneering mouth full of chrome teeth, the decorative swoops up the sides, which could almost have been sleek locks of slick hair. He felt something, all right. Perhaps it was nothing but childish awe of the unknown, the terror kids feel when standing in front of houses their hearts tell them are haunted. Or perhaps it was really what Kurt said. Perhaps it was watching them, gauging the distance. They looked at it, hardly breathing. It sat there as it would sit for all the years to come, while presidents came and went, while records were replaced by CDs, while the stock market went up and a pair of skyscrapers came down, while movie stars lived and died, and troopers came and went in the D barracks. It sat there real as rocks and roses, and to some degree they all felt what Mr. Dillon had felt, the draw of it. In the months that followed, the sight of cops standing there side by side in front of Shed B became common. They would stand with their hands cupped to the sides of their faces to block the light, peering in through the windows running across the front of the big garage door. They looked like sidewalk superintendents at a building site. Sometimes they went inside, too, never alone, though. When it came to Shed B, the buddy system ruled. And they always looked younger when they did, like kids creeping into the local graveyard on a dare. Kurt cleared his throat. The sound made the other two jump, then laugh nervously. "Let's go inside and call the Sarge," he said. And this time,